Welcome to Partially Derivative, the show about data, data science, drinking, and awesomeness. Our top data-related articles and blog posts from the past week. And don't forget, if anything doesn't make sense, just blame it on the drinking. Links to all stories we discussed today are available on our site, partiallyderivative.com, and on Twitter at PartiallyD. My name is Jonathan Morgan, and with me is my co-host, Dr. Chris Albin. First, we are available everywhere. iTunes, SoundCloud, Stitcher. Second, if you're listening on iTunes, we really want your reviews. We want to share data science with as many people as possible, and your reviews are a great way to help us do that. So if you have time, help us out. Go leave a review. Third, we want your feedback. If you have comments, complaints, cool data stories, shoot us an email, hello@partiallyderivative.com, or hit us up on the Twitter. So, most importantly, the easily most popular topic we ever discuss on this data science podcast, beer. Chris, what are you drinking?
I have a big, you know, admission this week. I feel like I was posing for a few weeks, but I have actually been called out on an email by a listener who said that I really needed to up my game. So this week I am drinking a Legend Oaked Brown Ale from Tommyknocker out of Colorado. It is 10 ABV and a deep, deep smoky color. It kind of tastes like wrestling a brown bear, except for a little bit tipsy. It is a strong, strong beer. So I've gone full circle. No more posing for many weeks to come. We have a lot of beer coming.
Awesome. So my beer is, I think, going to trump yours. I also went the extra mile this week. It's called Bourbon Country. It's by Goose Island Beer Company. It is a coffee stout, and their logo, by the way, is called Made with Intelligentsia, which is not pretentious at all. It's also super alcoholic, so if one of us doesn't start slurring by the end of this podcast, it's going to be a win. All right, Chris, I think you have the first story this week.
All right, yeah, first story goes to me. Banking startups adopt new tools for lending. And this story comes from Steve Lohr of the New York Times, and he reports on a new breed of banking startups that are taking an interesting big data approach to a very classic problem in the world of economics. So, Jonathan, when you want to buy that new Ferrari or that new, you know, 40,000 square foot house, what do you do?
Did you – a 40,000 square foot house?
Clearly my expectations are pretty high right here.
Well, I think in that case, maybe I'd like play Powerball or just like gamble on the Cleveland Browns or get a loan, because there's lots of banks that would loan me enough money to buy a 40,000 square foot house.
Right. The loan is the correct answer to this question.
A loan. Yes. I think that's what you were looking for.
So to determine whether you're being able to repay that loan, the banks use – typically they use credit history. That's a very classic thing. We all have a credit score. We've all looked at that and figured out what that number means. However, there's these new cadre of young companies that are trying something really interesting. And instead of just looking at your credit score, they're actually looking at thousands of different indicators, including, just as an example, did you fill out an online form with all capital letters? What kind of posts are you putting on LinkedIn? And how long are you spending reading online terms of service? And the really interesting part of this is, rather than relying on one variable, your credit history, these companies are digging up everything they can about you and compiling it together to create a picture of who they think you are. And in data, this is a concept that's called the mosaic effect. That is, it's the ability to figure out a piece of information you don't have with a hodgepodge of information that you do have. And that's what they're trying to do. They're trying to figure out whether or not you can pay based on all these little side points of view. And the interesting thing about this is that, you know, where they're looking at this information, one of the companies called Affirm has explicitly said that they're not looking at theories as to why one of these variables works or doesn't work, let's say capital letters. They don't care. They're not building this grand theory of sort of, you know, economic credit repayment. What they care about is just, you know, going through and mining for correlations. What correlations matter in the people's ability to repay? And it's really interesting to note that these kind of prediction systems are completely untested. There's no mountain of scientific research that says that all caps is going to, you know, determine repayment of a loan. They're just,
even though anecdotally we all know that's true.
that's exactly. I've never repaid anything. They're just putting it out there and seeing what will happen. And I think this says so much about sort of this big tent model of data science that, you know, I suspect that some of the people who are listening to this podcast who come from the research and science background would balk at the notion of just mining for correlations with any kind of theory behind them. But others who, you know, probably come from a computer science background would probably balk at the idea that you could never, you know, predict anything without coming up with some grand theory of why it works. And that's why data science is so cool right now, is that people are coming in with so freaking diverse backgrounds and different approaches. It's this like huge area of innovation that hasn't been seen in a long time. But I will say one piece of advice for these firms, you know, from one data scientist to another, if you are mining social media data for my creditworthiness, please make Snark a positive indicator, because otherwise I'm uncertain if I could actually get a loan for a ham sandwich, let alone a house.
Yeah. I think I see a lot of interesting tweets coming out of you, Chris, that definitely predict creditworthiness. I think, you know, a little known fact for our readers, when my wife and I got a loan to buy our house, I actually filled out the entire application in emoji. So I think that's probably why it's a small house.
Sad panda reduces your room.
Yeah, totally. All of those excessive thumbs up when they asked me how my job was. Seemed fine. But you bring up a great point about the different reaction to, you know, correlation mining between technologists and researchers. I think even though I'm usually on the tech side, I obviously understand that the fact that two things correlate isn't necessarily meaningful. You know, it's like that totally hysterical website, Spurious Correlations, the one like... I saw one that the number of annual swimming pool deaths correlates to the number of movies Nicolas Cage appears in. And that the number of people who die tangled in their bedsheets, which happens, like people die tangled in their bedsheets, that correlates to the U.S. capital consumption of cheese. So if you live in Wisconsin, sleep without bedsheets. But in this case, like, I'm not sure if it actually matters. Like, I am going to side with the technologists on this one. If there's any, like, it just doesn't, I don't care if there's any causation in the correlations a firm is discovering, frankly, because if the way someone communicates on social media is a reliable predictor of their creditworthiness, I mean, from the perspective of a company who's just interested in making money from loaning to that person, like, who cares why it's true, right? I mean, like, personally, I'm curious. I'd love for a researcher to answer that question, but I just don't think it matters to the technology company's bottom line.
Absolutely. Snark for credit. That's the future.
It's the present, my friend. It's the present. So our next story number two, goes to me. This is about the Mario Brothers and, wait for it, regular listeners, the singularity.
Oh, God.
So the singularity is real. It's here, and it's Nintendo. You guys probably know that Chris and I are both big fans of whimsical data science inspired by a fictional geekery. Star Wars API, love it. Predicting fictional zombie outbreaks, awesome. In fact, Chris spent a considerable amount of time making a Game of Thrones data set so we can all know, like, by the numbers, whether Robb Stark or Jaime Lannister is the better commander. Go check it out. I'm pretty sure it's on GitHub. Today, however, we meet the mothership. So Carissa Bell at Mashable is covering a team of researchers at Germany's University of Tübingen.
It's your native German coming out right there.
Absolutely. So I'm sorry. It's got one of those little those dots over the U. I have no idea. I just assume that in German it means like... In any case, there's a university that we will link to on our website so you can see how it's actually pronounced. The point is, they've released a project called Mario Lives, and it's a self-aware Mario who learns how to navigate the Super Mario game all by himself. The character Mario responds to questions like, how are you feeling, in English or in German, which is cool. But what's cooler is that as Mario experiences his environment, he learns how to interact with it in a way that is, like, wonderfully naive. I love the stuff that he says. So the first time he meets his nemesis, the Goomba, he says,
I don't know what that is. But then the researchers tell him to jump on the Goomba, right? So if you've ever played the game, you jump on the little bad guy and he squishes and then he dies. And so when the researchers tell Mario to jump on the Goomba, he then says, if I jump on the Goomba, then maybe it dies. And so like AI Mario is like a naive babe in the woods finding enlightenment through Goomba assassination. Like, I love it. So fortunately for humans, Mario, the Singularity Mario, he seems pretty amiable and isn't hell-bent on world destruction or enslaving mankind for now. What I love about this is, like, it's not the unsupervised learning or the speech recognition, which is great, but the speech recognition, I think, was a drop-in feature from Carnegie Mellon, and AI that can tackle 8-bit video games is, frankly, not all that new. But what's cool is that the intelligence was modeled on psychology. So Mario literally learns how to interact with the world based on his emotional reaction to experiences, like just like people. In fact, I think not only does he kill Goombas and figure out how to navigate or whatever, but, like, when he feels hungry, he goes and collects coins until he feels satiated, which is super weird, right? So, like, it's a great proof of concept. And I love that what they're doing is quantifying and modeling things that normally people give this sort of fuzzy, quasi-mystical status, right? Like emotions and feelings. But it's really just a bunch of neurons firing in sequence in response to stimuli, right? And we can totally model that. And one step closer to us having robot friends, and more importantly, me and AI Mario grabbing beers after work.
So, okay, like, I get it that this is probably a gimmick to make the news. Like nobody would care if we had a self-aware actor in some iterative prisoner's dilemma game, you know, figuring out that he was really sad for the other guy or something like that. Like, that said, I actually really like this use of basic video games to explore the idea of learning and AI and understanding. But I have a more fundamental question. So I played a lot of Mario in my day, and Mario, with maybe four other characters, rampages through this world, slaughtering thousands of other inhabitants and destroying like untold amount of masonry. Like, my question is that, like, you know, my question isn't when Mario is going to become self-aware. It's rather that when Mario is going to have a soul, because he is a horrible person. And
no, wait a second. Wait a second. It's not like Mario is going on a totally unprovoked rampage. They stole the princess. The evil dinosaur, Bowser, stole the princess, and he had to rescue her. So he's like Bruce Willis in Die Hard or something. It's not as if...
it's like Taken 5, Mario.
Taken 5. I'm gonna win.
All right, next story. On a similar vein of soulless entities, our next story is about the stock market.
Oh, zing.
For those of you who do not know and have never used it before, Alibaba is a huge online marketplace, ubiquitous in Asia. Think about it as sort of halfway between Amazon and eBay. You typically don't buy individual items through Alibaba. You rather buy like large lots, like let's say 200 blue dresses or 1,000 model airplane motors or something like that. Needless to say, Alibaba is huge. It's a huge B2B commerce, you know, company. And in addition to that, Alibaba also has this other part of it, which is an online payment platform named rather uncreatively Alipay or Alipay.
Oh, that's Ali interesting.
That's exactly right. So to get a scale of how big Alipay is, on November 11th, 2014, which is a really big shopping festival in China, it processed 9.3 billion in transactions. That's a B. Billion.
Whoa.
That is a lot of money going through their system.
Wow.
So now Steve Johnson in the Financial Times is reporting that Alibaba is moving into the world of finance and creating a stock market index based on Alibaba and Alipay's proprietary data. And as a quick explainer, a stock market index is a ranking of industries or companies based on submetric. And there's a bunch of them out there. I'm sure you've heard about them, the S&P 500, that kind of stuff. But what is really interesting about this new index is that it actually uses that huge swath of proprietary payment data only available to Alibaba to determine how companies are tracking or how companies are doing based on, you know, the price of their products or maybe how much of their products are selling. And this is so cool. If I had a big data cowbell or maybe a gong or something like that, I would be ringing it right now. Because holy crap, this is actually big data in action. And yes, big data is all a rage. Everyone's a big data person. You know, we've all heard about X is going to do this amazing thing with big data, or the future of big data is Y, and that kind of stuff. And I think we're kind of getting all a little bit, you know, burnt out with the idea of the big data hype machine. And it's even gotten to the point when someone says, oh, you think you have big data, but you really have small data. It's almost like a trope at this point. Like, we've all moved on. But this is it, people. This is a moment that a real company has gone and taken their real big data, and they're creating a real big data product from it that will make real money. This is a moment. We should mark this with, like, you know, I don't know, some kind of banner or something like that. Like, billions of transactions are going on through this payment system through the whole globe. It is possible for them to go and track entire industries based on the fact that this is a B2B commerce giant. They know when people are buying less motors and more dresses or something like that. This is a great way to create a stock index, and that's what they're doing. And it is actually, in my mind, very rare to see people using big data in such a good way. And we're seeing it right now. This is cool. This is super awesome.
I think, Chris, this may be your mission accomplished moment someday in the future. No, for real, though, I'm excited. You know, Chris Albin's finally getting on board the hype train to big data town.
Choo-choo.
Seriously, though, I mean, this really is a great use case for quantitative investment strategies based on big data. So obviously, like, I think everybody knows there are these quants on Wall Street predicting the future with complex statistical models. But I think most of these big data tools for analyzing, or at least trying to analyze and predict the markets, are built on effectively quantified inferences, right? So, like, Bloomberg News has a mining apparatus where they collect text from many thousands of newspapers and blogs and social media feeds, and then they use natural language processing and machine learning to guess how stocks will perform, right? That's the whole point of markets, is to beat the market, to figure out how they're going to perform before they do. And there's actually a smaller startup based near me up in Dallas called Hedge Chatter, and they predict stock fluctuations based on only social media sentiment. I guess I've even had some friends that have used it for paper trading just to see how well it performs, and it's a pretty decent predictor of how stocks will move. But the point is that all of these markets are based on, like, investor confidence, right? So, like, the fluctuations in the markets are based on fluctuations in investor confidence. So how companies actually perform is less important than how people with money feel like they're performing or will perform. Hence, like, the strategies that all of these organizations take, where they're trying to figure out, like, how the world feels about a particular company that's trading in a given market. But it'll be interesting to see how investors react to an index that's driven by an entirely quantitative metric, right? So, like, sales volumes. That's it. I mean, ultimately, numbers are released to Wall Street or whatever, and analysts, you know, report on those numbers, and then they make predictions about stock performance. But ultimately, like, what people do when they invest is that they make their decisions based on some kind of watered down assessment of those numbers, filtered through, you know, like a 25-year-old Wall Street analyst. And so the fact that big data and machine learning models, like a more technical, strictly quantitative process, will be making those assessments is I agree with you. It's really fascinating. As much as I, you know, I joke about the fact that you finally come on board with the whole big data thing, this is a really great, it'll be an interesting, hopefully it'll be an interesting proof of concept that this is the way forward.
Yeah, I am on the train now. I feel like my salary has probably increased, like, at least 50% now that I'm on the train. So I
tomorrow or in next week on the podcast, we'll only say Hadoop. All right. So, staying within the realm of power, our next story is the grade level of presidential speeches. So this is not grading them, like, how well written is the presidential speech, but this is talking about the audience to which the speech is targeted. So American listeners probably know that earlier this week, the president gave his annual State of the Union address. So for non-American listeners, the State of the Union is pretty much the annual all-hands meeting where the president talks to everyone in his government about how he's great and America is great and how the opposing party is screwing it up for hardworking, everyday people. It's basically political theater, but it's really good political theater usually, so everybody watches. Okay. So a publication called Vocative did an analysis of the language in the speech and found that it was actually targeted at the average 14-year-old, or more exactly, people with the intellect and vocabulary of the average 14-year-old. Vocative actually analyzed 600 different presidential speeches dating all the way back to Woodrow Wilson, who was president in the early 1900s, and they found, unfortunately, what you'd more or less expect, that the language presidents use has been slowly dumbed down over the generations. So it used to be targeted at the average well-educated adult, and now it's targeted at, like, emoticon-using tweens. Which all I know sounds kind of like angry grandpa stuff, like the world's going to hell in a handbasket, you know, kids these days and blah, 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 blah. But it's actually apparently, according to different speech writers, it's more a result of a more populist approach to speech writing. So, you know, older presidents only cared about well-educated rich people, but now presidents talk to everyone, you know, at least in their speeches. So I love text analysis. I love it. I think it's really difficult for people who don't spend all their time with numbers to really connect with analysis that uses only numeric inputs. Like, it's frankly just a little too abstract. But we use language constantly, right? It's part of how we experience the world, and it's full of emotion. And understanding what people say and how they say it is a key to understanding how people behave and what's important to them. So, I mean, this is a simple example, but it gives us an insight into how the relationship between the president and the American people, I mean, maybe even the nature of national politics, we could say, has changed over the last 100 years. And I mean, the caveat that I always give with text analysis is that language is really complex. It's full of nuance, it relies on context, and generally it's still pretty difficult for machine learning models to understand it. It's important to keep the analysis really focused when you're working with text and resist the temptation to infer more meaning from the outcome than is really there. Nevertheless, this Vocative piece is a great conversation starter. Like, I think it actually is really focused, and it's worth discussing why presidents have changed the way that they communicate with the American people. So it's a great piece. Definitely worth checking out.
Yeah. As a political scientist, I am swooning right now. This is so, so cool. I mean, what, you know, it's not really that cool that our national discourse is slowly spiraling towards a State of the Union involving, you know, lolcats and emojis or something like that.
By the way, did you see the Emojibama Twitter account during the State of the Union?
Oh, my God. That's where we've gotten? Oh, this is horrible.
It was amazing. They were translating the entire speech line by line into emojis. It was so cool. Like, tweens are like, oh, my God, we have a president.
I finally understand what's happening in my republic. So I'll say that part is pretty worrying. But it is so cool that people can figure this stuff out, you know, using relatively simple tools. And I completely agree with you about textual analysis. Like, text is a hard, hard type of data to analyze. And I haven't done that much work with textual analysis, but I've always had some very high levels of respect for the men and women that do. Because for all my complaining about, you know, mislabeled, missing variables or floats that are really integers or something like that, it is nothing compared to the dirty, dirty data that textual people have to deal with. I mean, you know, let's say you want to analyze, I don't know, text messages that are coming out that mention San Francisco. Well, that's going to be pretty hard because people say San Francisco, or they say Frisco, or they say San Fran, or the city, or the Bay Area, and they do so in lots of different languages. And even worse, nobody can spell worth a damn. So kudos to you, brave textual analyzers. Continue to fight the good fight, because I'm glad I'm not doing it.
Yeah, absolutely. And the weird thing actually about text analysis is that even when it's really clean, even when you're going to just go ahead and discard all of those little, you know, annoying, dirty nuances that you're talking about, even then you get something back where you're like, well, let's see. My unsupervised learning model has spit back 7 words that were relevant in defining a particular topic in this corpus of, you know, 1,000 emails that I'm looking at. And those 7 words are so bizarre and unrelated to one another that, quite frankly, I have no idea what the machine thinks this topic is. You know, like ice cream and oil spills and and meetings after lunch or whatever. Like it is really difficult to extract some kind of meaning or find some kind of signal in that noise. But I agree with you. The people who do it well are really pioneers. It's exciting to watch.
Heroes, even.
I think that was part of the president's State of the Union.
All right, next story: the code we cannot control. So I'm going to do something I actually really hate, and so I'm going to ask for all the listeners' forgiveness in advance, but I'm going to talk about an article about a book that I have not read. So there's an article in Slate by David Albrecht that talks about a new book called The Black Box Society by a University of Maryland law professor called Frank Pasquale. And just as a note, we're going to link to both the book and the article on partiallyderivative.com. So if you want to go check it out, it'll be there.
Yeah, maybe you can read it and tell us what it really says.
That's right. I have it on pre-order or I have it on whatever, like early order, whatever it is. So
all right.
Pasquale's book is about the dangers of two phenomena, and he's calling them runaway data and black box data or black box algorithms. Runaway data is when data has been gathered on you, let's say by a marketing company that is sold to another company that's sold to another company with no oversight. So it runs away from you. And this type of runaway data actually happened to a friend of mine in a rather famous case. So Lisa McIntyre, who is my friend, is also a notable feminist writer. And one day she received a credit card offer in the mail from Bank of America. This is all very normal. We all receive hundreds of these a year that say we get a credit card. And however, Lisa's email or Lisa's letter was actually addressed to, and I'm dead serious, Lisa is a slut McIntyre. That is her name on the printed envelope. And, you know, it's very obvious that this letter was printed automatically through some program. But that is both a blessing and a curse, because since this letter was, automatically printed, it's complete evidence that there is a database out there that has her in it, that's being sold from company to company with that being her full name. And imagine if this database was used by a company to do a background check for, let's say, a job that she was applying for. Would it affect her chances? Well, maybe. And, you know, what's even worse is that she has no recourse. Like, yes, Bank of America apologized, whatever, but she can't do anything about it. She can't, you know, go in and correct the database. It's out there in the world at this point, and all she can kind of do is wait for the next letter to come in. The second concept that Pasquale talks about is probably very familiar for people who listen to the podcast. Black box algorithms are something that, you know, just what they sound like. They're algorithms that are closed off from people who they affect. So let's say a credit applicant gets denied. They don't really understand the algorithm. They don't know why they were rejected. They were just rejected by some vague algorithm. Now, I wouldn't bring up this article except that David Albrecht actually has some great points against the author of the book. And he actually has this really great position to make these arguments because, in addition to be a writer for Slate, he used to be a software engineer for Google. And so one of the great points that he makes is that Pasquale overlooks this internal dynamic to organizations. And this will be very familiar to everyone who works in data science, that specifically, you know, the engineers that build these algorithms can't really say for certain why something was classified in a certain way, like how exactly an algorithm behaved out in the wild. So, for example, you know, let's say you demand to know why an algorithm rejected you from a credit card application. Well, in truth, you know, without tearing apart the algorithm, it's really hard for them to tell you what rejected you. You know, like maybe it was some part of your credit score, or maybe it was that you used all caps for something, or maybe it was because of some runaway data set. Like that is really hard to figure out. And it's even harder for the fact that, you know, machine learning is becoming even more popular. And that authors, you know, these algorithm authors aren't even making explicit decisions about every single part of it. They're actually sitting back and saying, all right, I'm going to run the algorithm, you know, I'm going to run machine learning, some kind of machine learning algorithm on a training data set, and then I'm going to release it out in the wild, and it's going to figure out how to classify stuff. But that means that they don't know exactly how things are working. And, you know, that's a really great point. That it's true with, you know, all the algorithms that I've run, like, sometimes I've run analyses that I know how every single variable is working, and sometimes I don't. And, you know, I'm okay with that. And so it's a really high bar to set to say that, okay, well, it was this one particular teeny component that told you this one thing or not, or that kind of stuff. But that is the argument of the book, and that is the counter argument by a Slate author.
Yeah, I think I'm really glad that you brought this up. Like, this is an important thing to discuss. And, you know, we talk about it a lot as almost like algorithms are intention from the point of the organization or the engineer who wrote it in the first place. And I think this book and even the commentary on it, in a lot of ways, it feels like it's in the same ballpark as the hand-wringing about science, that it's too complex or it's difficult to understand relative to general knowledge, right? And so therefore, we should be skeptical of it. And I'm not like excusing Bank of America for sending your friend that offensive credit card or debating with the Google engineer about how his algorithms are constructed. But I think it's really easy to draw parallels between this line of thinking and, say, a charismatic actor with an anecdote about how vaccinations have damaged her children's health, or a persuasive politician who uses some unlikely cold spell in the Midwest to scoff at climate change, right? So I think in all of these examples, the bad guy is a scientific wizard wielding unchecked power with techniques that none of us can understand, and therefore it just seems fishy, you know? Like, it doesn't sit right with my gut. And I think it's, you know, technology run amok, messing with things that we were never meant to understand, and blah, blah, blah. And I mean, obviously you can understand how I feel about this line of reasoning. And I think every technology is like this. Like, my car might as well be a black box to me. I have no idea how it really works. Just like I don't know how my television renders moving images or how my smartphone can connect my voice to people I'm chatting with halfway around the world. And I think blaming algorithms or any other technology is just a cop-out. I mean, the people or companies or whomever who deploy these technologies, they, in fact, do know how they work. Somebody knows how it works. And they're responsible for the products and decisions that those technologies make. And even with the technologies that are well established, when Toyota's brakes fail, then they get sued. When Janet Jackson's wardrobe technology fails, CBS gets sued. And I think in this case, it's actually possible to understand which data points about a given person contribute to a particular outcome, like a credit score. And understanding these outcomes from a machine learning model is very much within our grasp. And the bottom line is that it's the responsibility of the company to make sure that they're capturing the decision-making data of that model if they're using it in a way that can impact their customers' lives. Because, I mean, technology is a convenient scapegoat, but it's really not a productive one.
I think that's a great the great point about, you know, technology sort of being this approach. I think there was actually an Atlantic article that we'll link to in actually the past week that talked about this idea of algorithms and data being this, you know, being almost a religion that no one understood. But of course, people do understand it, right? The people listening to this podcast are a lot of the people who understand what's going on with these things. And it is not, you know, it is not black magic, as we, you know, continuously say over and over again. But because a lot of people don't, you know, sit down and use R or use Python or something like that, don't work in this every day, they like to use it as a scapegoat because they've seen something on TV that's, you know, zoomed and enhanced some algorithm to figure out some magical outcome or something like that. But I agree, it's not the approach that's useful to people.
So stepping back from my soapbox, I'm going to move swiftly along to the sixth and final article for today's show, a total 180 from what we were just talking about. So this is about hearing the year 2014 through a data-driven instrument. This is super cool. So we talk a lot about the importance of telling stories with data. Building a narrative around your analysis helps give it context. People understand what it means or what it implies. And I think most importantly, why it matters. And great information designers can tell really rich, complex, or even, you know, moving stories with data. And Hush, a design agency based in New York, is moving beyond just storytelling. They've created an interactive experience using their data from the past year that's half science project and half kind of modern art. The metrics that they captured to build this experience were the following: computers in use, images made, positive sentiments, travel time, and late night food. So, like, I think basically capturing the experience of what it's like to be part of this design agency. And they plotted these metrics on 52 different graphs, one for each week of the year, and they turned these graphs into this sci-fi looking 3-foot sculpture with 52 different layers stacked one on top of the other. But it gets better because they've assigned a sound to each layer in the sculpture and hooked up a motion sensor so that when you wave your hand in front of the sculpture, it actually plays a sound for the data in each week of the year. So basically, like, you get this multi-sensory experience interacting directly with, or, you know, at least a representation of their data. It's like a data theremin. It's like the electric saw of data science. It's super cool. So it's a little bit out there, frankly. And I'm not sure any real knowledge is gained from waving your hand in front of musical modern art, but, like, it's cool, man. and that matters, right? Because the really beautiful interactive New York Times visualizations, this gives people a personalized, like, an emotional experience with data, right? Because data isn't all abstract zeros and ones getting sucked into a light blue vortex. You know, like, projects like this are a great way to take something that's still scary and abstract for lots of people and make it tangible and give it meaning. So we'll link to the video on the website. It's super cool. It's a really novel way to think about data.
Yeah. Well, I think there is not much more to say except play us off, Maestro.
All right. Well, I guess in that case, that's it for this week. Right now, you are actually listening to the Hush data sculpture. We'll have this play us out. You can come back next week. As always, we'll be talking more about data science. Credit for the music that you heard at the beginning of the podcast, of course, goes to Professor Click. Be sure to follow us. We're on Twitter at PartiallyD. You can visit us at PartiallyDerivative.com, where we post all the links from every episode. And of course, last but not least, you can follow me, Jonathan Morgan, at Jonathan Morgan on Twitter, and my co-host, Dr. Chris Albin, at Chris Albin. And we will see you next time.